Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast, the morning after the Wisconsin pandemic election. I'm Charlie Sykes. I actually did manage to vote in the election. We could talk about that. It's sort of the Orwell meets the Onion meets Animal House. And to talk about everything that's going on, because there's so much going on. Tim Miller, our contributor to the Bulwark. Good morning, Tim. How are you?
Charlie, it's so good to be back. And, you know, I've been receiving a lot of Twitter mentions asking why I haven't been invited onto the staff pod recently. It sounds like people miss me or hoping maybe I could bump out Ben Parker or Sarah Longwell on the next one. So we'll just throw that out there.
Every time we reach out to you, you're doing like, hey, I would love to do it, but I have to like do the Bill Maher show.
I do have a busy media diet. That's a good point, Charlie.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is one of those days where the news cycle was so fast. Of course, we've said that about a million times. You have, you know, the president firing the inspector general, who was supposed to be the watchdog for spending all of those trillions of dollars on the pandemic relief. So what could go wrong there? You have the Secretary of the Navy resigning. I mean, that was a great news cycle. I mean, the guy fires the captain of the ship, then gets on a plane, flies 8 hours to Guam, which is my favorite part of this, face plants by calling the captain, you know, naive and stupid. You know, the sailors are going, what the fuck with this guy? He doubles
that
down.
That audio was truly astonishing. If the listeners haven't heard it, whoever taped it was on, you know, was in the room. And so you can hear him getting jeered by the sailors.
I know they hate and so he's out. And if there was any doubt about what a slug this guy is, his resignation letter, I mean, talk about a non-apology. I just had all the best people, and what are we leaving out, because we have all of these other things that are going on as well. And I want, you know, you have,
well, there are, I think, seven different news items coming out of every press conference / rally from the president with his, wrote about his obsession with hydroxychloroquine. There's our new birther White House press secretary.
Kayleigh, you know, McEnany.
I'm not going to try to pronounce it.
See, I'm not going to. Why bother learning? So, hey, I got to defend Stephanie Grisham because she's getting dunked on by everybody. The outgoing press secretary. You know, the one thing you can say about her, in contrast to all of her predecessors and probably successors?
No gratuitous, embarrassing lies.
No lies. No. Stephanie Grisham never lied at a White House press briefing. Never. Not once.
An important caveat.
That's right. At a briefing, she never stood behind that podium and told a, you know, Sarah Huckabee / Sean Spicer whopper. So, you know, she's got that record intact. Of course, she never gave a briefing. So, have you ever encountered her? You ever been on one of these cable shows?
I've never encountered her. I mean, she only does Fox, and I don't. Maybe they still have you on over there.
No, she used to do CNN.
Did she?
Yeah, that's where she sort of, you know, cut her teeth being a flack on CNN originally.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Man, I don't recall that. I guess we must not have overlapped then. No, I've never encountered her. She was in Arizona. Kind of local Paul for a while.
There was a reason. Yeah. You know what? I'm in a mood this morning that if we keep talking about her, I'm going to say something really, really mean. And so let's just move off of all of this. So what was the main, can I just make a comment about Wisconsin before we move on? I know that people are probably sick of Wisconsin, but it was such a surreal scene here yesterday. All these people lined up with the masks and everything, some of them in driving rain trying to vote. Also, how bizarre is it? We had an election and nobody won, nobody lost because they didn't release the election returns. I mean, it's just so
Monday.
They won't do it until Monday. So we had a contest between Bernie and Biden and have no idea. Actually, really, nobody cares at this point. We elected a Supreme Court justice. Nobody knows who it is. But my favorite moment, I mean, there are some iconic scenes out of the iconic images. And in my newsletter, I published included the picture that was in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It was taken by a college intern for the paper. All these people standing in line with the masks and a woman holding the sign saying, this is ridiculous. She had to stand in line for more than 2 hours. She said, I'm disgusted that I requested an absentee ballot almost 3 weeks ago, never got it. I have a father dying from lung disease, and I have to risk my life and his just exercise my right to vote. And then you juxtapose this with my good friend, Robin Voss.
In the hazmat suit?
Speaker of the State Assembly. Apparently Rick Wilson knows him too, because we were texting late last night about this. But anyway, so Robin Voss is the guy who's really been driving the, hey, this is no big deal. We need to open up the churches on Easter Sunday. This is exaggerated. He had actually retweeted Dr. Drew. He was the guy, of course, who said we have to have the election on April 7th. So he shows up at one of the polling places. I'm not making this up. As an election inspector, in full hazmat gear, whole, you know, full head-to-toe PPE, wearing the face mask, wearing the gloves, saying you are incredibly safe to go out. I mean, this was the Orwell meets The Onion meets Animal House. You know, Animal House, everything is fine here. I mean, this was like, have you lost all self-awareness here?
I mean, he looked absurd. I am a full, I am extremely on board and adamant that people should, when they're going out, ensure that they're, you know, concerned about their health and their safety, wearing N95 masks is appropriate. I purchased some masks myself. You know, I'm going a little bit more for a hipster style with my mask, but I understand wanting to go with the full N95. But I mean, this guy is like fully ensconced in a trash bag of PPE, standing up, telling everybody that everything is cool. It's like, it's just, I mean, what, how is there not one iota of self-awareness about how that looks? It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, that's the key thing about the self-awareness. Do you understand how you look? And when I say that it's Orwell meets The Onion actually, somebody did actually dig this up. There is actually a thing showing Mike Pence, it's a fake picture, in a giant yellow hazmat suit visiting I think in one of those the immigration centers on the border saying, hey, everything looks fine here. And that was a joke for them. And in Wisconsin, it's what we got. So anyway. I'll have more to say about Wisconsin a little bit later on. Is the dysfunction, and you know, part of it is so. Tim, I know this now sounds old, but I mean, I know these guys, yeah. And I really am wrestling. And I know people will say, "Oh, Charlie, you're so naive. You're such a hypocrite." I know these guys, and I'm still trying to figure out how did they go from what they used to be to now. And I guess maybe it's not that much of a mystery. You know, it's sort of, there is a certain arrogance of power. You know, a swagger becomes a strut. You take that kind of hyper-partisan tribalism that I was certainly part of back during, you know, the Walker years. And then you add in a dose of Trumpism and a total lack of self-awareness, this arrogant win-at-all-costs culture, and you get Robin Voss dressed up as Hazmat
power, though. I mean, you know, Evers beat Walker. This is not the height of the, the Wisconsin mafia had their moment where they were the ascendant and powerful group within the party. If it's just, you know, the scent of success that is driving this, wouldn't that have been happening back in, you know, the glory days when Reince was RNC chair and Paul Ryan was on the VP ticket and Scott Walker was the golden boy governor, and that was, and obviously they made mistakes at that time as well. But, I think the added ingredient is pretty obviously Donald Trump. And he has created a sense for people that they can be their worst selves. And so he's given them a green light to kind of explore their shadow side, as a shrink might say. And I think really, have their full id, come out. And it's just that there are no reins on this. I mean, I one of the things that I reflect on, having worked with Reince at the RNC is, we really thought, like, we recognized, this, what's the phrase you always use, Charlie, about, the party, how this, the recessive gene, we recognized that this was out there. You know, it's not as if we didn't know that there was a lot of, racial you know, animus out there, that there were, you know, people that maybe weren't, you know, fully on board with the, you know, conservative project and just were on board with some of these cultural issues. But we kind of felt like we were the guardrails. And I think that was completely wrong. We were absolutely incorrect about that. And I think that's, you know, a period of, that's my reflection looking back on it, is, you know, we felt like, okay, we can prevent the crazies, you know, the worst crazy impulses of the people in the coalition, by, you know, just throwing them some chum from time to time and then kind of putting up these guardrails. And Donald Trump, you know, basically said, screw all that, you know, let everybody's freak flag fly. And so, you know, I think that, you know, is, you know, my answer to that reflection is that this was always there, and that, you know, the new order just basically says, well, let's amplify that rather than try to contain it.
Yeah, well, two things. First of all, I'm having one of these PTSD flashbacks of having lunch with Reince Priebus in Milwaukee. We were at the Cheesecake Factory at Bayshore Mall, so it's all coming to me now.
That's a very Wisconsin setting that you've just said.
It is. Although the Cheesecake Factory has very healthy salads. You can get some really low calorie salads and stuff. But you wouldn't think you'd go to the Cheesecake Factory to eat healthy, right?
You wouldn't.
No, but okay, but you can. So this was right around the time that he was shiving Michael Steele. I can't remember whether he had become the chairman or he was about to become the chairman. But he was dealing with the Republican National Committee. And I remember him sort of leaning across the table and saying, you know, seriously, half these people are insane. They are just insane. So he has no illusions about that. Of course. Again, as you point out, he figured, yeah, but we'll find a way to, you know, keep them busy. We'll come up with some sort of a knitting project for them, and, you know, off in the side. But go back to this this Wisconsin mafia thing, because it wasn't that long ago that we did have the cheesehead domination, that you had, you know, Reince Priebus was, you know, was the chairman of the Republican National Committee. And then, you know, White House chief of staff, Paul Ryan was the speaker. And, you know, Scott Walker was this rising star, and they're all decapitated. They're all gone. None of them are significant players anymore. So you have guys like Robin Watts. It's sort of the second generation. It's like there's a mob movie here where, you know, all of the mob, the top guys are taken out. And now you have sort of, you know, your second tier enforcers. The guy that, you used to be Tommy Knuckles somehow. the guy who was the bag man, and now he's running running all the deals. So I think there's a little bit of that we're sort of in second tier Wisconsin mafia type thing. Okay, so
that certainly could be true. Can I play the role of host here, Charlie, and intervene?
I thought you wanted to talk about the cheesehead. Yeah, go ahead, host.
I'm receiving a lot of alerts on my phone because Bernie Sanders has dropped out of the race for president of the United States.
Oh, my. Whoa.
And, you know, I'll give everybody a little behind the scenes image here of what happens at a news outlet like The Bulwark. I had pre-written the autopsy for Bernie's campaign since, you know, we all knew it was happening. And so it has just, you know, gone up, and I'm having people send it to me. But the takeaway that I put in for that, and I'm interested in your response, Charlie. I don't know if you read what I had back in the CMS there, but for Bernie, the main lesson is that is something that you and me learned in 2016, which was, it's a good lesson for life and for campaigns, which is, don't believe your own bullshit. And we believed our own BS when it came to why Donald Trump couldn't win the primary. We believed our own BS when it came to why Hillary was certainly going to win the general. And, you know, I think we spent a lot of time rather than wargaming and focusing on the ways that we can appeal to, you know, the voters that Trump ended up winning over in the end. You know, instead, we spent a lot of time dunking on him and being self-righteous. And you know, here's the result. It's that Donald Trump is president. I learned that lesson the hard way in 2016. Bernie did not. And his campaign completely believed this false narrative that they had put out, which was that he was going to expand the electorate, that the Democratic Party had moved into his camp, that he didn't need to reach out to the neoliberals, that he did not need to, you know, condemn Fidel Castro without caveat. that he just needed to be pure uncut burn, and that would be good enough. And here we are.
Yeah, here we are. And your piece is up in real time at the Bulwark. Bernie Sanders dropped out because his campaign believed its own BS. I'm sorry, I'm laughing at the artwork.
The art is so good.
Well, our art director Hannah Yost is truly gifted. I mean, this is the secret sauce of the Bulwark. But I mean, that picture of Bernie Sanders. Oh my Lord. You know, look, it's a podcast. You have to go look. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but it's kind of got a little Easter theme there. Did you pick that up? Because that's where you go. It's working on several different levels. So why do you think he dropped out now as opposed to 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago,
two days ago? Honestly, I don't know. You know, and so maybe he said this is kind of happening while we're talking, but maybe they've given a reason. But it would seem to me like the Wisconsin debacle gave him a beautiful opportunity to, you know, kind of exit gracefully, right? I mean, I think that had he come out on Sunday and said, this is just a total disaster and I don't want our voters to be out there, I'm going to drop out, that gives given an opportunity. I did see a counter theory, which maybe is the case, and maybe they'll say this on Twitter, which was the opposite, which is that he didn't want to drop out before Wisconsin because of these Supreme Court races, and he thought it might lower turnout. So
I can see that.
Public health versus the Wisconsin Supreme Court value judgment. Maybe that was it, or maybe something, who knows, altogether different.
It is interesting. Right up till the end, though, he was convinced that he won the debate, the ideological debate, when it seems pretty obvious that the story here is that Democratic voters went, no, we don't. We're not buying what you're selling. We're not going along with your stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, especially this is the most stark after South Carolina, you know, and I was sitting on my couch here in Oakland watching his concession speech. And, you know, he went into South Carolina, as everybody knows, a pretty significant front runner at that point. And he received a drubbing, and the drubbing was at the hands of two very important parts of the Democratic coalition, suburban women mostly, but also men, suburbanites who are more moderate, and African-American voters. And he went out that night and gave his same exact speech that he always gives, but he spent an inordinate amount of time, that even more than he usually does, on this issue of how they're going to turn out the new voters and how that's how they're going to win, and they're going to stick with their plan. And I'm just watching this thinking, have you not paid attention to the last month? I mean, there were, even in Nevada, where he won in a landslide, there were no states where he won on the back of this massive surge in turnout, and he just got his, you know, his butt handed to him in South Carolina by Joe Biden, whose campaign at the time was dead. And there was just not an iota of self-reflection that actually this isn't going to work. Like, there aren't these magic bean, you know, Jill Stein voters out there that are going to surge to Bernie's, you know, side and put him over the top. He's going to have to win with actual Democrats. And it just never clicked.
You know, I'm going to give you some credit here, because you'd written, writing sort of warning about Bernie before the establishment was taking him seriously. And I remember you saying that there's a bit better chance that he's going to win this nomination than people are giving him credit for, and they're not responding. And you were kind of like waving the flag. And then you wrote that epic piece in the Bulwark, which I'm going to, you know, when I write my memoirs, I'm going to say this was one of the turning points, where you said to Democrats, you now have 11 days to save your party. In 11 days, Bernie Sanders is going to lock this thing up. It's going to be too late. If you come in and you make the endorsements, it's not going to happen. And you were flashing back to what happened with Jeb Bush and others back in 2016, where people were waiting, keeping their powder dry. And you said, you can't do it. And I'm guessing as you wrote that, you're thinking, you know, I'm going to be Cassandra. I'm spitting into the wind. But Democrats seem to take it for, I mean, it happened. I mean, it was.
I did, yeah. And I think the black voters and Jim Clyburn get about 98% of the credit, but I'm going to take 2%. So
I'm going to give you, you 4.5%.
Yeah, I think that that's right. And I do think that there was an appreciation after Nevada and after, you know, what I and others were saying and writing among the Democratic, people in the Democratic Party that like, oh man, this is over sooner than we think. And we need to consolidate. And they did. I mean, obviously it just went on much longer on the Republican side. And I do think there's an alternate universe where, you know, Biden's victory in South Carolina is not as dramatic, where Pete's victory in Iowa is more clear. There are other circumstances, I think, where the field, the non-Bernies, if you will, stay fractured for longer, and he's able to kind of do what Trump did. I also think, to the point of the article, though, Trump was more adept in kind of in a totally shameless, shambolic, I can't believe people bought this sort of way, but whatever, like, he at least attempted to appeal to everybody. You know, I mean, Trump, people forget Trump did quite well with moderate Republican voters, particularly in the urban areas and in the Northeast, like by basically, you know, code signaling to them that he thinks that Ted Cruz is a crazy evangelical and that like he's a more of a whatever pragmatic businessman. And so Trump was able to put together a coalition that included, you know, the far right crazies, the immigration hawks, the people that hated the establishment, but also a decent amount of, in the end, establishment people. You know, he brought on Bob Dole, and, you know, John Boehner basically said that he's, you know, would support Trump over Cruz and others. And so, so there were, I think, two things at play there. Trump benefited from circumstance. Three things. Trump benefited from circumstance. He was better at appealing to, you know, the more mainstream parts of the party. And three, we and the establishment on the Republican side just weren't very good at this as far as uniting against him.
Okay, so you know,
hey, I have four, actually, Charlie. Yeah. One other important thing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There is this. It's also the electorate. You know, I do think a lot of folks who are Bulwark listeners, people like us, have moved into the Democratic camp, I did some work with a group called Center Action Now that we tried to push people into the party, but a lot of this had happened naturally. And I do genuinely believe that the makeup of the Democratic electorate partially because of the new blood of suburban voters who came in 2018 and 2020 as a result of Trump, partially because of, you know, I think a more pragmatic base in the black electorate than the evangelical base turned out to be. I think that was sort of the last piece of the puzzle for keeping a populist insurgency from happening within their party.
I think you're absolutely right there. And I think you can back that up with the numbers. Now, you know how toxic Bernie world can be. In fact, I was noticing, you know, now that we're, you know, talking about Wisconsin again, and being a Wisconsin guy, I'm getting all of this sort of, you know, progressive hate tweets, you know, like, we don't need you, we don't want you, you know, you built all this. And I was like mildly curious about it. I mean, I'm entertained, but mildly curious. And, you know, 99% of them are, of course, Bernie bros. And the Bernie bros are out there, and they have adopted this, and we've talked about this before, this toxic persona. So without dwelling on that too much, what do you think? Some of the polls suggest that a large number of the Bernie supporters will not vote for Joe Biden. They will either just sit out, vote third party. And there are some polls suggesting that maybe 15% of the Bernie folks might say, just screw it, we're voting for Donald Trump. So what do you think happens now? What does Bernie have to do? And does that make any difference?
It makes a big difference, I think. And, a lot of the Bernie people will defend him. And I think that they have a point in the, from, you know, a 10-foot level, maybe not from a 20,000-foot level, that Bernie did campaign for Hillary, and he did whatever, 22 events or whatever it is that is their talking point. It atmospherically, though, the signals that he sent were not great. You know, the picture, the image that I have burned in my retinas of Bernie sitting in the stands in Philadelphia and just moping during the convention, kind of sitting alone and frowning, you know, letting the Bernie, supporters, you know, create a lot of trouble at the convention, really. Not that he could totally stop them, but he sure didn't seem very motivated to tell him to not, you know, create trouble for Hillary at that convention. It didn't ever feel like his heart was in it. And you know, some people in Biden world tell me that they think that Joe and Bernie are not, you know, maybe best friends, but they do have a good relationship over spending a lot of time together in the Senate over the years in a way that Bernie and Hillary did not. Maybe that will make a difference. I think that there are some voters out there who are Bernie voters who really are like, Trump really is their second choice. I mean, I think that they're, I don't think that this is a majority of the electorate by any means, but I think that there's a significant minority of Bernie voters who their animating issue is just how much they hate the, you know, globalist establishment. And, you know, they're more liberal than Donald Trump. You know, they don't like, you know, jailing children necessarily. But at the end of the day, what the thing that animates them most is negative partisanship towards the neoliberals and the neocons and the globalists and whatever, whoever else you want to lump in there. And that's mostly men. These are the Bernie bros, by the way, that I'm talking about now.
Right.
It's mostly men who are, you know, maybe not. I guess I don't want to put them on the couch, but in my experience, a lot of them have not maybe had the life success that they wanted, and they're upset and they're angry, and they're angry at the establishment. They're angry at the, you know, people they went to high school with that are whatever, you know, have gone along with it. I think that Biden does lose some of those. And then I think that there's another kind of category of just hardcore progressive liberals that right now might be saying that they're not going to vote for Biden, but like at the end of the day, they're going to.
Yeah. It is amazing how that works. Okay. A couple of hot takes here. So Bernie suspends the campaign, says the struggle continues, but as Dave Weigel points out, by suspending the campaign today, Sanders is probably not going to get he'll probably get less than 25% of the available delegates, which would prevent his bloc from challenging Democrat platform rules changes at the convention, which is interesting. Also, Jonathan Lemire from AP points out, with Sanders out, Biden now clearly the likely Democratic nominee, this now frees up another voice, Barack Obama. He can play. Well, that's going to be interesting. This is also interesting. Here's a little tidbit from Steve Kornacki. This is the earliest a contested Democratic primary has ended since 2004. Boy, people did not see that coming.
Wow.
I mean,
remember all those hot takes about the contested convention?
The contested convention, the brokered convention, and remember all of the candidates that were on that stage? And here you have Joe Biden. So... wow, that's an interesting moment.
Yeah, and I mean, and he really did. He ended up in the end clobbering Bernie more significantly than Hillary did. If you look at like across Super Tuesday states and across, you know, after South Carolina, it was a drubbing. And the Hillary race was legitimately kind of close. I mean, Bernie never had, you know, there was never a point where you're like, is he going to win, in a serious way? But he kept it close all the way through. She was not just, you know, annihilating him in every state. I mean, there was the one day, I guess the week after Super Tuesday, where Biden won every county in Michigan and Missouri and Mississippi, and he killed him.
All right, let's pivot for a moment. There's gonna be plenty of time to do all this, but you had a piece yesterday that I want to actually. You've had a bunch of stuff lately, including this updated story.
Quarantined, Charlie. I'm just quarantined and drinking iced coffee and just pounding out articles. So yeah, let's do it.
Well, I want people to go and to bookmark your piece about all the warnings ignored, because this is constantly being updated, and it's. The documentation about Donald Trump keeping his, having the information and not acting on it is so overwhelming. And when every day we learn something, I mean, even Peter freaking Navarro wrote a memo. And of course, this is important to do this because you know that the Trump folks are going to try to memory hole this. You know that there's going to, you know, be this attempt to rewrite history, and you know that Donald Trump will, you know, jumped on this. You know, he sealed the borders, he solved the problems, he brought America back. And so it's important to constantly go back and say, no, let's do a timeline of what he said. And I feel like we should have two charts: what he knew and what he's, you know, what he should have known, and what he was actually saying, to get us to the moment we're at right now.
Yeah, I'm trying to work on that, how to visualize it for, you know, maybe some future bowl work stuff, because I think that this is critically important. And given that I've written on this and you know, wrote this timeline called Warnings Ignored, I get a lot of, you know, replies on social media, which I sort of use as a little focus group, which is probably not smart or real, but at least it gives you a sense for what the Trump might not give you a sense of real life, but it gives you a sense for what the Trumpers are going to say. Mm-hmm. You know, because the pushback that I keep getting is on this, that, well, look, he was early on the case on banning flights from China, while all these Democrats were, you know, saying you should go to Chinatown and hug your, you know, grocer or whatever, you know, whatever they were saying, and calling them a xenophobe. And they keep going back to this, and that he was actually the early one, right? I mean, they've convinced themselves of this now, that it was actually Trump that saw this first, and it took a month for the media and for the, you know, Democrats to come around, and they base it on the one decision on the China flights, which I'll talk about in a second, and they base it on just these absurd cherry picked, you know, the one tweet from Vox and, you know, one opinion piece in the Washington Post. You know, they cobble this together to create this alternate narrative, and so it is critical, you know, I think over the next 6 months for people who don't want Donald Trump to be elected, that recognize how poorly he did, to continue to drive what happened and what was in this real timeline. And the reality is that for basically from January 3rd, and the Post did a great narrative version kind of this timeline a couple of days ago that I would recommend. But, you know, it basically, you know, is over over 10 weeks, over 70 days, starting January 3rd, Donald Trump did basically nothing except for downplay this, with the exception of the China travel ban, because he was worried about the stock market, because he was worried about his reputation, because he wanted to keep his death numbers below Barack Obama's H1N1 death numbers, and he didn't take it seriously. And that's just the reality. And so if you go blow by blow through this warnings timeline, it is stark.
It is.
And I tried to focus, Charlie, not on like Democratic cheap shots in this timeline. I really tried to focus on Trump officials' warnings, former Trump officials' warnings, conservative media warnings. Trump should have gotten the joke here. By the end of January, Scott Gottlieb and Luciana Borio, who both worked for him, Borio was on the shutdown pandemic team, so that's especially noteworthy. You know, Tucker by February 3rd was on this. Azar was, you know, is kind of, I think, a little bit of a mook, but he was on this early and trying to get Trump's attention. There's this great Post vignette where Azar calls Trump, tries to get him on the phone, can't get him on the phone, finally gets him on the phone January 18th, and Trump wants to talk about vaping instead. There were a lot of warnings, a lot of warning signs missed.
Well, and what I love is the fact that you keep updating it, and you keep, you know, this stays live. This is one of we can do this in the digital economy. By the way, I'm looking at social media right now while we're talking about this. You know what's trending?
What's that?
The term "damn Bernie," and it's from the Bernie folks.
They're
mad at him. Damn Bernie suspended his campaign. I got to vote for one of two sex offenders now. Damn, Bernie wasn't perfect, but he was so much effing better than Biden. Here's another one. Damn Bernie, I waited in a 2-hour line to vote for you. You were the only hope most of us on the ground have. I'm not even sure I'll vote again. To be honest, the next 4 years will look exactly the same no matter who wins. Memo to you. Damn Bernie Sanders stepping down again hurts a little more this time. Well, here's another one. Damn Bernie, you really had to break my effing heart, huh? Damn Bernie dropped out. Now we got to choose between red and blue sex offenders. Apparently that meme's out there. So it just goes going on and on and on. As of damn Bernie, now I have to vote for Joe Biden. Damn Bernie, out of the race. Now we got to choose between a racist orange and a senile MF. Damn.
Okay, by the way, Charlie, I just want to look you. Again, Bernie only has so much responsibility for the insane people that want to support him, right? But his campaign, you know, if you, you know, this is something I know we've all talked about. If you truly believe that Donald Trump is an existential threat to the country, and I don't know how you can spend the last month and not believe that anymore, but you have an obligation not to, you know, whatever, lie on behalf of Joe Biden or not to, you know, whatever. But you certainly have an obligation to not smear the person unfairly that is most likely to be able to end this nightmare. And the Bernie campaign, all of this stuff was bubbling up for the last month. I heard you talked about this a little bit on your podcast with Jonathan Chait, which was great, excellent. And they felt, the Bernie folks felt like they needed a kill shot, you know, because Biden was so far ahead. And so they went straight to, you know, this dementia and sex offender and all this stuff. That stuff is going to stick. The Republicans are going to use it. The Republicans are already using it. The Trump crowd is already using it. And it's just, Bernie had an obligation during that period to say, hey, guys,
like, don't go there. Yeah.
Like, this is wrong. Like, I know Joe Biden, you know, Joe, and maybe he'll do that now, and maybe he'll do it in a way that's convincing enough to mute it. But some of the damage is already done on that.
On the allegations against Donald Trump, the sexual assault harassment allegations, Kathy Young has just a fantastic piece on Medium. I mean, she walks through the allegation. I mean, she points out sort of the irony of the Me Too folks, you know, who are now saying, well, now we got to give Joe Biden the benefit of the doubt, you know. But the main value of her story is the reporting she does, step by step, deconstructing the allegations against him and raising real questions about the credibility. So I, you know, that story is not actually going to go anywhere. But the fact is, you're right. Now they've actually thrown it into the water. They've basically, you know, tossed it in, and it's going to be around. Here's my favorite damn Bernie tweet, though. Damn Bernie dropped out and Pornhub was down this morning. These are dark times we are living in. So, no, this whole notion that I mean, the Bernie folks, that there's no difference between Trump and Biden, that the next 4 years would look the same as the last 4 years. I mean, have you guys been paying attention? Now, look, you know that I really am reluctant to play you know, the sort of the intense racial victimization card here. But, you know, and I'm sorry to go back to Wisconsin again, but we had another story as well yesterday at the same time all this was going on, that this coronavirus is hitting African Americans at a much, much higher rate than other populations. It is a very significant, you know, risk group. You're seeing there's staggering numbers out of Chicago. And there's a lot of reasons, you know, for this, including medical and, you know, income inequality and everything. But if you look at the pictures from Milwaukee, the areas that were the most impacted by this in-person voting were largely Black areas. I mean, it was, you know, Republicans and the Trump folks are saying there was really no problems in Wisconsin because, look, you go into rural Wisconsin and there were no lines. There was no wait there. Well, yeah, it's because in the city of Milwaukee, that's where it was concentrated. And so the impact of this is horrendous. So I don't know. I think part of it is that if you think it can't get any worse, it can get worse. And I don't know
how you can think that anymore. But
I know. Okay, so one more, because I really had to talk about this, because this president continues to push this unproven drug, and bizarrely, this has become part of the culture war out there. And there's some even rational people on the right going, well, you know, maybe he's right, maybe this is out there. And it's like, are you kidding me? Well, first of all, I'm not a doctor, so I've been stepping back. But you wrote a piece that, you know, I'm throwing all these, like, you know, roses at your feet here, you know.
Please,
like,
I'm taking compliments.
This was, you know, kind of broke the mold, because you said, okay, let's look at, why is Donald Trump pushing this snake oil? And you reminded us.
I've been practicing how to say it.
Yeah, okay, good, because I wasn't going to try. So, what is it? How do you say it again?
Hydroxychloroquine.
Do you know how long who was the Iranian leader? I was on the radio. Ahmadinejad. And you know what? It took me a long time, you know? So I actually practiced by calling him, I'm a dinner jacket. Okay. So he's pushing the snake oil. And you reminded us that, well, one of the reasons he's doing this is because this is what he does. It's in his bones. It is his brand. So just briefly tell us that story.
Yeah, as I wrote, like you, I'm not an immunologist, so I have no idea whether hydroxychloroquine could work. It might. I've actually talked to, I have a lot of friends who are doctors, because one of my best friends went to med school, and some of them are optimistic about it. So who knows? The point is, Donald Trump doesn't know. right? And so the question is, why is he pushing this? And while I may not be an immunologist, I am unfortunately a Trumpologist, having done oppo on him all through 2016. And when I'm watching his press conferences, it is a ringer for the same stuff that he was saying on these infomercials that he was doing. People, I think, forget there's this kind of dark period in the Trump life, right? He was this kind of 80s bad boy, always in the tabloids, and then he gets on The Apprentice, and The Apprentice takes off. But there's a period in between there where Trump's kind of struggling. You know, his brand is not hot, and so he, puts his name on everything under the sun. And one of these things was a pyramid scheme called Ideal Health. And with Ideal Health sold these like Maxi Power vitamins that'll help you, get thin and stop cancer and, everything under the sun. It was just one of these garbage schemes where they hire people to sell it to their friends and, go on down the line. And in 2004, they receive an FTC complaint about, for false promises that one of their vitamins will cure cancer. After that complaint, Donald Trump says to himself, this is the kind of company that I want to invest in. So Trump buys the company, puts his name on it. So now he changes the name from Ideal Health to the Trump Network. So it's still the same pyramid scheme vitamin. It's like the knife salesmen's, your friend's kids that try to sell you the knives. It's like that, but for phony vitamins. And Trump does a infomercial for these things. And then he ended up doing them for some other things as well. But the vitamins is most relevant here. And this is right during the financial crisis. And the whole pitch is basically the pitch he's giving now. Trump's going to give you hope. This is how you can skip your way out of the recession. This is how you can jumpstart your life by selling these pills. The miracle vitamins that are going to work for you. It is the same thing that he's doing now. It's offering people false hope, telling people that there's an easy shortcut fix to the problem, to buy himself time until he comes up with another scam. And so for Trump, it was the Trump Network, and then he bought this group called ACN, and then it was the Trump University, which everybody's heard of. He was just a traveling scam monorail salesman for a whole decade, and this is his instincts. It's the easy fix. Promise people an easy fix, take their money, and then once they realize that it doesn't work, you're already on to the next scam. And so, I think that's what he's doing here. If hydroxychloroquine doesn't work, he's bought himself a month, and then maybe the legit vaccine that Fauci's working on will be ready, or maybe something else will come down the pike. He doesn't know what's coming down the pike. He doesn't care. He's just trying to survive the next 20, extend the scam another 24 hours.
Or the next 20 minutes. And he's already got the excuse built in, which is that I was just being optimistic. I was trying to provide hope. That's my job. I'm being a cheerleader. And so if I made people feel better about themselves during all of this, what's the harm? And we are all living through Trump University. I mean, that's the thing. That's the simulation that we have here. And did you actually link to, I'm trying to find it. Did you actually link to the ad? We actually have the audio of him selling his bullshit?
Oh, we do. Yeah. It's in there.
It's actually in there. Oh man, why is the rest of the media not covering this stuff?
Overwhelmed. Yeah, completely overwhelmed by his BS look, with Trump, as I said, I'm unfortunately a Trumpologist, having had to learn all this stuff, but I sometimes forget. Every once in a while somebody will mention something, I'll be like, oh right, I forgot that scam.
Okay, wait.
Scam artist here, for adventure.
Yeah, we're going to drop this in, okay? Well, I have to listen to this.
Hello, I'm Donald Trump, and welcome to the Trump Network. I want you to know why I'm so excited to be a part of this great organization. At no time in recent history has our economy been in the state that it is today. It's a mess. The economic meltdown, greed, and ineptitude in the financial industry have sabotaged the dreams of millions of people. Americans need a new plan. They need a new dream. The Trump Network wants to give millions of people renewed hope and with an exciting plan to opt out of the recession. Let's get out of this recession right now. With cutting-edge health and wellness formulas and a system where you can develop your own financial independence, the Trump Network offers people the opportunity to achieve their American dream. I'm still looking for dreams. I'm doing damn well in life, but I'm still looking for the dream. It's a winning combination because it means you and your family can benefit financially from our breakthrough program. Follow our step-by-step success system that will help you grow your business. This journey is going to be a fantastic one, and you're going to have a lot of fun. The Trump Network is positioned to help millions of people overcome the recession and achieve the success they've always dreamed of. I hope you're going to join us. It's going to be fun and hopefully very profitable.
Oh, dear God.
Sound familiar? I mean, he does sound a little bit more. I will say he's a little bit sharper. There's the words aren't kind of swooshing around as much as they do now, but it's the message.
All right. So for people who want to look behind the scenes, how this stuff actually works. So we started this podcast about 40 minutes ago. About 10 minutes into the podcast, we started getting all of the alerts that Bernie Sanders had dropped out. So we adjusted in real time. Right. And you actually posted your story while you were on the pod, while we were taping the podcast.
Well, right? You know, I think there are a couple of mice back behind this. You know,
okay.
Who posted it? So, but I did manage to tweet it after they texted me that it was posted. So I can multitask a little bit.
Let me tell you how this is working out, because I just got a notice on all of this that your post is now trending at a rate higher than 98% of the posts published in the Bulwark in the past 90 days. And the main referrer was yeah, absolutely. So I'm looking at the chart and it's like, it's erect. And what can I say? It just went straight up there. So, you know, hey, look, we've all been in quarantine too long.
I can't you can't even start to take me down that road, Charlie.
All right. So here we go. It's Bernie's out. The daily scam continues. And you know, again, and I've used this phrase too many times, I know this, I'll have to retire this one too. On Earth 2.0, we probably should have spent the entire time talking about what is the President of the United States now doing with, you know, firing the inspector generals? What does this mean? You know, you want to talk about a populist insurgent, because what I remember about a lot of the populism after the last financial crisis was that sense that all this money was being doled out, that system was rigged, there was all kinds of waste, you know, too big to fail. And we're about to live through something very much like that, you know, $2 trillion being doled out by the Trump administration that clearly does not want any meaningful oversight. I mean, what could possibly go wrong? And I have to say that I'm struck by how feckless the Democrats in Congress are, that they are not pushing back even harder on all of this. I mean, they will have a chance in stimulus number 4, but how did they get into bed with Trump, you know, this fully on this, on the bailout, except that everybody's getting their goodies and we are so screwed. Did you follow what I meant there?
I don't have an answer to that. And it seems so obvious. Like if you're, I don't know, this is where maybe, you know, we have the clarity of being in Oakland and in Wisconsin, but it's just like, why is Nancy Pelosi should just be making the cash machine go burr, you know? Give people cash. I just like, what is with all of the, you know, well, I'm going to try to cut a deal with Trump on a payroll tax, and somebody floated a capital gains tax. It's like gains tax. It's just, you know, the Democrats should just be all in on, we've got to make sure waiters and, you know, bartenders and other people who've lost their livelihoods are just getting cash payments till this is over. I don't know. Maybe somebody like Jim Swift with more Hill expertise could weigh in on this.
He worked on the Hill, you know.
He did work on the Hill. I heard that.
Yeah. Did you guys know that I worked for Senator Kyle?
Oh, really?
Really? From Arizona?
Yeah. I worked for him for 4 years.
Do you know where else you worked?
I worked at the
Weekly Standard.
I worked in the House too.
No, I know. Oh, you worked in the House and the Senate.
Yeah.
Well, can you explain this, how this deal goes? Because it almost feels like there's, you know, they get in the room. It feels like whatever really negative caricature you have is probably taking place. I'll give you this if you give me this. We'll take care of our buddies. And as a result, there's got to be kind of a ceasefire, because Nancy Pelosi, you can't have these unanimous votes and then have the Democrats stand up and say, hey, you know, look at this sleazy giveaway, right? I mean, that's part of the problem. Who's going to be the check and the balance on this burst of corporate welfare and grift?
Nobody. And you know, this dates back to the 2008 economic crisis, where, I mean, if the short answer is it's the breakdown in the committee process. Once Congress stopped passing budgets and appropriations bills, everything became backroom deals and just leadership negotiating with leadership about, you know, what each side was going to get. And, you know, we've been operating that way for the better part of a decade. And for as much as, you know, populism is on the rise and everyone wants to say they hate backroom deals, that's really the only way Congress functions.
That is depressing, because this is one of the things. And, you know, we were talking earlier, Tim, about, you know, how politics in Wisconsin has devolved. And I think it's parallel to this Washington process, where you have, you know, four or five people in a room at 3 a.m. cutting the deals. There's no debate. Nobody gets to read the bill. There is no committee. And that kind of power is going to corrupt. That kind of power is going to turn your head and, you know, breed suspicion, because it ought to breed suspicion. But I don't know who's going to blow the whistle on it. Especially if they're all in on it. That's why we need Bernie. Damn Bernie. And he's gone.
Yeah, I don't have this is where we need to bring in some of our Democratic friends to ask them for some clarity on this one, because I can't.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, now that the race is over, we had been having this speculation for months that, you know, you Democrats are really, really bad at politics. You just don't get it. And the reality is that they're not. They actually were able to do something that the Republicans failed miserably in 2016. Sure. And you got to give them credit for this, that they shut this thing down. And boy, if you were a betting man, you know, a few weeks ago, that this thing would be absolutely done on April 8th, people would have thought you were nuts. You could have gotten some pretty good odds.
For sure.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you so much on an extremely busy day here. I appreciate it very much, Tim Miller and the cameo appearance from Jim Swift.
Charlie, it was wonderful. I'm going to go back to isolating. We'll talk to you all soon.
All right. And Jim Swift's going to go back to isolating too. Hey, thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.